Hocken and Mike Snediger are on. Bill Resnick interviews John Foran. John Hocken and interviews Kate Raphael about her new novel. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a member? Go to kboo.fm and click and donate today. Stay tuned. This is your community connection, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Mayoral Candidate Forum on Social Justice, March 10th at 6:30 p.m. at Maranatha Church in Portland. The forum will be a public conversation with leading mayoral candidates about social justice issues in our community. The program will be moderated by Israel Bayer of Street Roots, Joanne Hardesty of the NAACP Portland Branch, and Jason Renault of the Mental Health Association of Portland. Again, that's the Mayoral Candidate Forum on Social Justice, Thursday, March 10th at 6:30 p.m. at Maranatha Church, 4222 Northeast 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Eco Plumber, providing sustainable plumbing services to Portland and the metro area, including remodels, repipes, and repair, as well as green projects such as rainwater or graywater harvesting, and alternative materials such as 100% VOC-free green pipe. Information at 503-342-8244 or eco-plumber.com.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:01. Up next, the Old Mole Variety Hour. Make sure to follow us on Twitter and join in on conversations and up-to-the-minute updates or special programs. Just search for KBOO online or on your favorite Twitter app to find us. Learn about station news and find out about recommended events and see what we're talking about, whether it be news, interviews, or music. Now here's the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is listener-supported community radio. It is time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this March 7th Monday. Joe Clement is our engineer. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks with John Foran about the danger of climate change. Climate change is threatening to make the planet uninhabitable, but the response by the U.S. elites has been feeble. Why and what can be done? Jan Hocken interviews Kate Raphael about her new novel set in Palestine titled Murder Under the Bridge, A Palestine Mystery. Joe Clement interviews Austin Rose, organizer with Portland Tenants United. They discuss an upcoming training with Rising Tide and Right to Survive. It's a training for fighting evictions and houseless sweeps Wednesday, March 9th from 4:30 to 8:30 p.m. That's at the SEIU building off of 64th and Foster. And Jan Hocken and Mike Snediker talk about the Oscar-winning film Spotlight. They put a spotlight on the film's portrayal of the priest's sexual abuse cases of the 1980s and 90s and take up the parts of that story that were not covered in the film's valorizing of the Boston Globe and its investigative team. I am Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and thanks for tuning in this morning. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and John Foran.
John Foran, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks so much, Bill.
John Foran teaches at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He tells his students, it's in his syllabi, I Consider Teaching a Revolutionary Act. His books are on the revolutionary process, and his current interests are the climate crisis, global justice movement, sustainable development, and building better futures. He's now working on a book, Taking Power or Remaking Power, Movements for Radical Social Change and Global Justice. And he helped found the national organization System Change, Not Climate Change. John Foran, as I read it, the great majority of climate change experts, academic scientists and government scientists, also the leaders and scientists of the climate action movements, all of them agree that if we substantially mobilize for the next 30 or 40 years, every year cut emissions by 3% or so, we can reduce global warming to manageable levels. On the other side, all those same scientists also warn that maybe we do not have that much time, because they call them tipping points, that these might come to operate, natural processes actually, that might come to operate to leave us much less time. John, tell us about these so-called tipping points and give us some examples.
Well, I think you've characterized that very well. I think we're between a possible future of dangerous climate change and extremely dangerous climate change. And we're operating in that space in between, trying to make it in 30, 40 years from now to a situation where the climate has changed minimally. All the science is quite clear, even though people are really having a hard time, and even the people that follow it closely are having a hard time accepting the existential reality of it, I think. The tipping point question is what is kind of the wild card in the deck, because climate being such a complex system, it means that things changing in one area of the climate can have, they're called positive feedback effects. Of course, the effects are truly disastrous. And so, for example, one of the reasons that warming of land surface temperature has been lower than expected is because the ocean is absorbing a tremendous amount of heat and carbon. And of course, that's bad for the ocean, right? The ocean warms, that affects all of the marine life in the ocean. It creates the conditions for more superstorms because there's going to be more moisture in the air. And we get into situations where things don't increase in a linear way, and they're hard to stop, not just linearly, but the possibility of a kind of runaway situation. And I think there's a realistic danger of that in the next 20 years. I certainly think the next 10 to 20 years depends completely on what those people alive today, let's call us one generation of people alive on the planet today, how we step up to this challenge. And it has to be really all hands on deck, and it has to be a kind of collective effort that's never been seen before, I think.
Let's get a little bit more graphic about the tipping points or these natural processes. One of them, you mentioned the ocean. The ocean also acidifies. Certainly algae concentrations are declining in lots of parts of the ocean. Some fear that these algae that take in carbon dioxide and extrude oxygen, they're dying off. And if they do, carbon dioxide concentrations are going to rise in a number of different ways when they decompose, as well as the fact that they're not taking the carbon dioxide from ocean water that got there by absorption from the air. I mean, that's just one of those sort of natural processes that could greatly increase the concentration of greenhouse gases and maybe doom us.
Indeed. The oceans are really a critical area. Of course, everything is critical at this point. How we fare on land, the oceans, the atmosphere, and it can be all interconnected. And so one of the big dangers as the planet warms is melting of ice caps, and that's going to raise sea level. Ultimately, it could affect, we know what the effects of sea level will be. It means that the 60% of humanity that lives within 100 miles of the ocean is going to be on the move. And the huge amounts of capital that are invested in cities all over the world are going to be lost or have to be defended at tremendous cost. Another area in the Arctic, and certainly in Russia above the Arctic Circle, is as permafrost melts, that's going to release unpredictable amounts of methane into the air. And methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, which, while it's around less time than carbon dioxide, is really going to give us immediate warming. So we face a whole bunch of dangers that aren't really, scientists can't put them into their models very easily. So what we're hearing from the scientists, for example, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which gives us the state of the art of climate science every 5 or 6 years, you have to take that as the most conservative scenarios and really kind of work from there. And again, it's hard to do, but we know that it's coming. And there's something called the precautionary principle, which means if there's a chance, however small, of something extremely catastrophic happening, we need to address it. And climate is case number one in point.
One final thing about these feedback loops or tipping points, natural processes, there's possibilities of countervailing processes that reduce the impact. And I think that's one of the reasons that scientists just can't deal with it. You can't quantify all of this stuff, I mean, all of this material. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour talking to John Foran, who teaches at University of California, Santa Barbara. He writes on and agitates, and he's a movement activist on climate change. What can we do to save the planet? We've been talking about tipping points or natural processes that would very quickly release vast volumes of greenhouse gases and lock in great increases in global temperatures, making actually much of the planet uninhabitable, or setting up social processes that so destabilize the planet that wars and conflicts could occur to wipe us all out is one scenario. John, making sure that none of these things happen would require, you got into it, in fact, a vast mobilization without precedent in some ways in human history, and certainly under the direction of the state. Is this so frightening, this sort of mobilization that would require, that even climate scientists, much less the country's elite, just refuse to contemplate these implications?
I think that's part of an explanation of our predicament, and not just climate scientists. I think climate scientists are extremely frightened at the prospects that we face, and I think they're extremely discouraged that it's not really their inability to tell us what's happening. It's our inability to hear what they're saying, and it's not even our inability, is it? It's the people that control economies and states, the 1% politically and economically, that have the power in this world to do the sorts of things from above that, in a sense, are going to be required to get us through this. That's, again, a reason why the only way to make them do these things, they will not do them unless we put enormous pressure on them. In fact, unless we capture positions of political power. And that's a long-term prospect, or at least a medium-term prospect. So we have to operate on an awful lot of levels. We have to immediately stop the extraction of all fossil fuels, which has become clearer and clearer as a political goal that's in tune with climate science. We have to speed up the rate at which renewable energies come on stream. We're going to have to make major social changes, particularly in wealthy societies such as our own in the global north. We're going to have to make do with a lot less energy and resource consumption than we have in the past. And it's all possible. It's all possible, but it simply won't happen unless a movement, in fact, a network of many movements in all kinds of places working together on all their issues and connecting the dots between them, gets up to speed and very quickly.
John Foran, you talked about get up to speed very quickly. It's enormously frustrating. So many people sound the alarm, both for the long term, and then others, in fact, talk about how this really has to be done extremely quickly. You talked about the precautionary principle. If some outcome is so horrible and so costly, like the loss of most human life, then one must take precautions, even if we're uncertain about that event or those events or that process is not going to happen. And that, I guess that's the precautionary principle, which is, in fact, is written in U.S. law in many places, but not as to the whole system. There seems no way of suing them to take precautions. In that, very little is happening now except a sort of, it seems to me, pretending or acting as if you're really doing something, but just sort of hoping for the best and hoping somebody else does it. That's sort of what international elites seem to be thinking. It seems to me we're on the road to a quite desperate situation. If we try and project what's going to happen in the future, it seems to me there is some hope. And I think a left can play a role. Some of it has to do with it that the people are going to wake up fairly soon. There is a lot of concern. It seems to me really severe climate events, frequent ones and dangerous ones, could lead to a relatively abrupt change of consciousness, sort of a Pearl Harbor period.
Yeah, that's the good news, and there is a reason for hope. And in fact, even if there was not objective reason for hope, we would have to be hopeful in order to secure the least worst future, which is what we're fighting for. We are, as one book recently published puts it, what we're fighting for now is each other. This is a crisis of existential proportions, and I do believe I can see very clearly in the last 2 years, in 2014, the climate justice movement taking big strides forward, gathering 400,000 people in New York City, for example, in September of 2014. In 2015, a whole series of significant things happened. The Pope's encyclical was very important. We have 1.2 billion Catholics around the world, and the Pope's encyclical is one of the more radical documents that's available to the climate justice movement. And that's not a fringe or a small group, 1.2 billion Catholics. We had Paris itself, which is a very mixed blessing, I think, despite the sort of triumphant self-congratulations on the last day of the negotiations that gave us the Paris Agreement in December of 2015. That glass is about 80% empty. And it's true, the leaders of the world are not acting with anything like the awareness and the courage and the vision that's required. And the elephant in the room, to my way of thinking, as an eco-socialist, the elephant in the room, of course, is the system that's driving all of this, and it's capitalism, with its imperative to expand and to grow, and its incredible emphasis on GNP, which includes complete waste of billions, really trillions of dollars on military expenditures, on advertising, on media that are mindless. There's so many ways that we could actually find the resources to turn things around if we had such a huge consciousness shift. And that consciousness shift, as I am saying and as you've implied, grows with every extreme weather event. It grows slowly over time as well as climate change and discussions of it force their way into the public debate. It grows in each generation because people from a very young age are going to be educated around this. It is pretty much impossible to ignore, and we can see quite clearly that that will be the case for the indefinite future, and that will grow and grow and grow. And that means, I think, that slowly and perhaps quickly and perhaps even quickly enough, great numbers of people are going to come around to the various positions that this is the number one problem, the solutions on offer. We have to choose the most serious, even if that means major changes in the way we do everything. In a sense, yes, that's scary. This is a critical moment. This is a tipping point for humanity, the 21st century. There's no question about that in my mind. It's scary, but again, because everything is interconnected, the way we organize our economy, our political systems, the way we grow food, the way we ship things and distribute things around the world, the way the global economy is so far flung and uses so much carbon to work. All of these things will have to change. And again, I agree with Naomi Klein, author of This Changes Everything, subtitle, Capitalism versus the Climate. I believe that not only is it a moment of crisis, but it's a moment of tremendous opportunity. If we seriously address climate change in all the ways it should be addressed, we could come out at the end of this in a generation or two from now in a much more equal world, in a much more democratic world in which people really do feel that their participation is effective, in a much less violent world. I mean, these are possibilities, but we're going to have to work very, very hard to achieve them.
One final issue, sort of a hypothesis, you can comment on it. It seems to me that in the near future, what we can do is set in place many of the sort of alternative, we have plenty of money to do it, certainly, the alternative technologies, the ways of producing power, the ways we transport ourselves, the kind of agriculture that we'd have to use that would tremendously reduce greenhouse gases, the way we build our homes, the way we design our cities, and the way cities are structured, and the tremendous emphasis on conservation of energy. If, in fact, climate action people are able to just gain the power to put in place sort of demonstration projects or model cities, when that crunch comes, when people finally awaken, there'll be models and political movements that people can affiliate with and mobilize towards just universalizing those kinds of technologies, those sorts of cities, the way people live, the way people work. And it seems to me it could sort of rapidly happen since there is so much wealth that gets people working and doing things together, sort of greases that. It seems to me that might be the scenario that we can look to. The other scenario, of course, is when people wake up, there's going to be a furious right-wing, xenophobic and militarist and corporate, who will want to take power and reconstruct for their ends.
There are two sides to this. One is stopping the destruction of the planet that's going on everywhere and immediately. And the other is, as you've said, to be constructing at the same time alternatives on whatever scale. And that's the good news. Both of those things are happening. And I think the global climate justice movement, which is not a single thing, of course, is a very complex network of networks, really, of people, of NGOs, of social movements, of organizations, of institutions at every level of society. The global climate justice movement, and particularly the younger people in it, see the two sides that have to be pursued. And yes, that's a reason for hope, and that's absolutely what has to be happening right now. Both of those things, stopping the bad and not just starting up, but building on what is already good and really using imagination to amplify that in every direction.
John, tell us what we should be reading.
Okay. Time for a self-advertisement and our work, the work I do with my colleagues who are mostly actually students and soon to be academics at the University of California, Santa Barbara, can be found online at www.climatejusticeproject.com. And we're constantly putting the results of our inquiries up, available immediately for free for anybody to read. That's one place one might go.
And there's the System Change, Not Climate Change blog. There are several others as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the short list of places I get my information includes such websites as Grist, EcoWatch, Resilience.org is a fantastic one. They published a lot of my work on Paris. And any organization that's serious about this, from System Change, Not Climate Change, to 350.org, it's not hard to find.
Yeah, I like the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, some of their work about alternative energy.
There's the climate mobilization, which has sprung up only in the last year and is a good example of organizations that concerned citizens are starting, and they're associated with something called the Pledge to Mobilize, and they're also ones talking very directly about a kind of World War II style effort to transform the way we do things.
John Foran, thanks so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning. I got Joe Clement here with me in the air room, engineering. Later on the Old Mole, you will hear from Joe Clement. He interviews Austin Rose. He's an organizer with Portland Tenants United, and they're going to talk about a upcoming training to deal with evictions and houseless sweeps. That'll be next Wednesday, March 9th. We'll have more details on that later in the program. And Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker will talk about the Oscar-winning film Spotlight. Next up, we have Jan Hocken interviewing Kate Raphael about her new novel set in Palestine titled Murder Under the Bridge.
Welcome to KABU, Kate Raphael.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, your new novel, Murder Under the Bridge, has been described by a number of reviewers as a riveting mystery story and an engrossing read with richly drawn characters. The main protagonist is a very smart Palestinian policewoman who gets involved in solving a crime that becomes a political investigation as the plot unfolds. Can you talk about how you were thinking about the crime, the murder mystery, as a plot device for thinking about the broader politics of the occupation of the West Bank?
Well, I went to Palestine between 2002 and 2005, I lived there for about 18 months, coming and going. And I was doing human rights work. I was traveling around meeting people who had experienced, well, pretty much every Palestinian has experienced some level of harassment and oppression from the Israeli army and settlements in the area. The area where I was living, Salfit, is, which is where the book is set, has a very high proportion of Israeli settlers, Jewish Israeli settlers to villagers, about 50% of each at that time. So there was a lot of settler violence and land confiscation happening all the time. And everyone that we met, people were extremely generous. They would open their homes to us. We would sometimes call it brutal Palestinian hospitality because you could not leave a house without drinking tea. And if you stayed long enough, they'd insist that you have coffee too. And, you know, people would want you to spend the night. They would kick their kids out of their bedrooms to make you as comfortable as you possibly could be in their homes. And they asked for one thing in return, and that was go home and tell people our stories. Tell people about our struggle. Having the possible misperception that if Americans only knew what was going on, that somehow we would be able to change U.S. government policy. But nonetheless, I felt an obligation, having taken people's generosity and their time to tell me their stories, to do something with them. And when I was there, I wrote a lot. I wrote letters home, you know, which were sort of circulated as blogs, sometimes reposted on websites. And that's one way to get the word out. But I was always thinking how to get it a little more in the mainstream. Adam Shapiro, who was one of the founders of the International Solidarity Movement, and I, back in 2002, would joke about calling CBS and pitching Survivor Palestine. And instead of demolishing a village so they could have a bunch of Americans live there, they could just take a bunch of Americans to an already demolished village and have challenges like, you know, get through the checkpoint and get food and get back before curfew without getting shot, and whoever got the most food could win. But we somehow didn't think we were going to succeed in that venture. And so right before I left, I passed a scene that was intriguing to me, that an Israeli car that seemed to be abandoned on top of, on an overpass that runs over a Palestinian road. And I thought, oh, what's going on there? And I said to my friend, oh, this would be a great way for a mystery to start. And I really love the mystery genre. I read a lot of mysteries. I read some while I was in Palestine. That was about the level of concentration I had for anything.
And mysteries often are about worlds that unfold in the process, that go beyond the investigation. I think you use that device very effectively. It kind of opens up a larger social world. But part of the social world you open up with the mystery, it seems, involves this other character, Chloe, who's an American, seems to be loosely based on you.
Oh, Chloe is nothing like me, because people seem to find
really, well, I don't know
annoying.
You. I don't know you very well, but she's bold, passionate, but naive, though you probably are not so naive. She represents aspects of the international support coming in from America. She's from San Francisco, which itself conveys a certain world, a very modern woman. But there seems to be a kind of ambivalence that runs through the novel about international solidarity networks. Am I reading too much into that?
No, I mean, I'm not ambivalent about it. I think it's necessary and important. I also think that the reason that you're there is to use your privilege as an American, in my case, as a Jewish American, to wave that blue passport and get through checkpoints that Palestinians can't get through, be able to run, go up and talk to the army and feel a relative sense of impunity and fearlessness that probably, I mean, it has happened, but probably they're not going to shoot you. Probably you're not going to be disappeared into a military prison for who knows how long. And in my case, that certainly all was true. And so there is an arrogance that accrues to that, even if you're not a really arrogant person to start with. And I will leave the jury open as to whether I am or not. But you know,
your portrayal of the character, so that's where that comes in, that Rania, the police woman, is very kind of suspicious of her and kind of corrects for something. Or there's a tension between them, which made the story interesting. It wasn't just an uncomplicated set of women's alliances, even though the complexity of women's worlds, including Palestinian women, is very much part of the richness of the novel.
Yeah, I mean, Chloe and Rania have a fair amount in common. They're both pretty headstrong and bold. They're both very passionate about justice. They're both very smart and cerebral. Neither of them is very tactful. So that immediately, and they're both very quick to take offense. So that...
That's part of how they bump up against each other.
They both are attracted to each other and they rub against each other. And I think that I probably would do that almost naturally in creating two characters who are going to be closely entwined in a story, just because you always want to have some conflict. You know, they say drama is conflict. And so you always want to have some tension there in a situation where everybody gets along very well. You don't have a very interesting story.
How did your feminist politics inform the development of the story? I mean, part of it is there are female protagonists who are complex and interesting. So on various registers of feminist politics, you can see that happening for you. But there also are other questions, maybe in terms of how you develop characters and think about a complex plot as a feminist. Could you say a bit about that?
Well, both of my protagonists are feminists. They would self-identify as feminists. So Rania is the only woman detective in the entire Northern West Bank.
Is that based on history? Is that actually
point of fact, I never met a woman in a job like that. And I don't know anyone who has, although I did hear from a friend that there was a black Palestinian woman who was the police chief of Jericho for a while, but I never met her. Jericho's a pretty different type of Palestinian city, so I could believe that that could be true. I mean, there are some Palestinian police women. I mean, U.S. aid to Palestine mostly goes for police and security. And at one point, there was this initiative. The U.S. government insisted that the Palestinian Authority train women, recruit and train women as police. They saw that as, you know, promoting gender equality. So there are some. I never met a woman in a job like this, although I can absolutely say that if there were a woman who wanted to be in a job like that, there would be people, both men and women, who would try to help her get there. And I have that in my story.
This is Jan Hocken talking today with Kate Raphael about her new mystery novel, Murder Under the Bridge. Kate, there's also an interesting theme running through the novel about the position of this Rania as a policewoman. And it's a fictionalized role, but it's compelling in that she also carries some of the tensions of the relationship between the Palestinian police and the people. There are a number of places where she has to kind of pull back. She has a job as a police to find out what's really going on. And that often happens in these detective stories, that there's a tension around the job of the police and the various claims on truth claims. It seemed like you were saying something this novel about the Palestinian police under the occupation more broadly, or policing.
One of my role models in terms of mystery writing is Tony Hillerman, the late Tony Hillerman, who wrote about the Navajo in Arizona, New Mexico, on the reservation. And very much like his protagonists, who are Navajo tribal police, Rania is the authority in Palestine. So she's in a potentially oppositional relationship to the people, although I have to say that in my experience and in her mind, the police are more protectors of the people than they are authorities over them. Policing in Palestine is not like it is here. They don't get deeply involved in people's personal lives or something. But nonetheless, I mean, in a situation like this where it's not clear what's happened, like she's going to be having to ask questions and people are going to be suspicious. So on one level, she has some power in her society. And yet, vis-a-vis the Israelis, she not only doesn't have power, but she's in fact more suspect because of her role as a police and because many of the Palestinian police, not in her case, but many of the men have been fighters and that's how they became police. Many of them are armed. Many of them are in some ways affiliated with some of the militant organizations. In situations of heightened conflict, often they are the first to be rounded up and they are very much suspected by the Israeli authorities. So there's this inside-outside situation going on both within her own community and with the Israeli authorities. And then there's Chloe, the American, you know, who in some ways, even though she has absolutely no official status at all, has more power than Rania in certain situations, more ability to move freely, more ability to go into, say, the Israeli Ministry of Defense and start asking questions. And that is, John, from my experience, that just some random American can command more respect from the Israeli authorities than a Palestinian police.
And you also point out how men can be seen as carrying authority coming into rooms as opposed to women. So there's this interesting gender dynamic around
and this is the
assumption of power.
And this is something that both Rania and Chloe are very sensitive to and quick to bristle at. And I mean, that was my experience very much in Palestine, and I wanted people to see that.
Well, it's a wonderful book, fascinating, great read, great mystery novel. I can't wait to see your second book, which you apparently are working on. But listeners can get a copy on your website. It's by Kate Jessica Raphael called Murder Under the Bridge. And where would you like people to get the book?
Yeah, kateraphael.com is my website, and if you click on buy the book, you can actually read the first couple chapters for free and see if you like it, and I hope you do, and then you can click buy the book and find out where you can get it.
It's terrific. Well, thanks so much for being here, and thanks for your good work. This is Jan Hawken talking today about Murder Under the Bridge by the author Kate Jessica Raphael.
Old Mole Variety Hour this morning. Later in our program, we will have a review of the Oscar-winning film Spotlight from the Mole perspective. But next up, we have Joe Clement and Austin Rose, both organizers with Portland Tenants United.
All right, I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm joined here with Austin Rose, an organizer with Portland Tenants United. Full disclosure, I am also an organizer with Portland Tenants United. He is here today to talk with us about a direct action training that will be the second that Portland Tenants United has organized along with Rising Tide and Right to Survive. I was unable to attend the first one because of work, but I look forward to this one at the SCIU building out on 64th and Foster. It'll be this Wednesday from 4:30 to 8:30. Thanks for coming on the Old Mole, Austin.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Before we get into talking about the training, I want to talk a bit about the context that gives rise for this all hands on deck kind of approach to the world we're living in right now. Could you give us your perspective on the housing crisis and specifically evictions in Portland?
Sure, Joe. Well, I've been organizing events to speak with tenants a lot in the last year, including the Portland Renters Assemblies. And one of the things that we hear time and time again, every time we get in a room with people who are renting, is that they are living in constant fear of these evictions. Either they recently have gone through an eviction or they know people who are close to them who have gone through this process. And so they know that at any time, this could come from around the corner and they could be completely blindsided with this thing that will completely upend their lives and change everything.
Last month, Street Roots interviewed a OHSU psychologist named Shia Lott about his participation in a emergency housing forum that was held in January, which hundreds attended, including many local and more state-based legislators. At one point, the interviewer asks, during the forum, you said, the reality is that the impact of no-cause evictions on families is multisystemic and devastating. How so? And Shia Lott's reply, quote, we can only infer what the health implications could be because everyone is different and the literature is still new. We have the potential for individuals looking for housing not going to doctor's appointments, not being able to afford medications sometimes for severe health conditions and sometimes severe psychological conditions. The literature is saying that individuals who have been forcibly evicted tend to be punitive in their parental style toward children. That struck with me. That's a trauma response. They have this hypervigilance. They have an inability to be comfortable. They're always on guard. They're afraid of getting evicted again. It affects the health of the children. It decreases a person's support network. Then we rely on ourselves, which oftentimes isn't enough. It could cause a person to lose their job. End quote. So do you have any experience with or sense of the kind of trauma that Lott is talking about?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm good friends with some people who have received no-cause evictions in the last few years. And one of the things that they talk about regularly is the long-term effects that that process had on them, both in terms of how much time after they were evicted they had to dedicate to finding new housing. And so they often had to postpone paid work and taking care of other things and needs in their lives in order to find that housing. But then also the long-term depression and psychological angst that was created when they were told that they didn't have a place to live even though they hadn't done anything wrong, right? And I'm speaking specifically to no-cause evictions here, which are a big problem in Portland, where a landlord doesn't need a reason to evict their tenant.
As you know, and probably some of our listeners remember, I was displaced from where I lived in Sellwood in 2014. One of the things that really stuck with me and sometimes is, you know, still with me is the feeling of isolation that I went through when it was happening, because what you hear from a lot of people is that you're just a renter and there's no sense of solidarity. But I get the feeling, and it's why I'm involved with Portland Tenants United, that we're trying to turn the tide on that feeling of isolation and trying to build a movement. So I want to talk a bit about the first training that you did on February 21st, which sadly I was unable to attend because of work, and what people might expect at this next training on Wednesday.
Portland Tenants United and Right to Survive and Portland Rising Tide have been organizing a rapid response network. And this is one of the strategies that can draw attention to the crisis that we're experiencing and also help people in their immediate lives. Both tenants and houseless individuals in Portland are getting the short end of the stick, and they don't have people stepping up for them to support them as often on an individual basis. And so that's one way that the community can come together to try and help repair that trauma that they've experienced and to create a support network and an actual community around the fact that this is happening to everyone. You know, 50% of Portland are tenants, and so that means a huge percentage of our city is experiencing these conditions of fear. And then also, as we know, we have a growing houseless population that is just being exacerbated by these no-cause evictions in the current housing market. And so we've decided that one of the best ways that we can help people both feel supported by their communities and stay in the places that they are currently residing is to come out and act in support of them through direct action. And so there is a CELI network, a way to get text message updates about defenses that are happening and actions that we're planning, both in terms of eviction defense and stopping the sweeps. And so if you text @sweep911 to 23559, you can join that text list and receive those updates.
Could you say that again?
Absolutely. Text @sweep911. To 23559. We're also organizing trainings for people so they know how to respond to these situations and what is a good way for them to plug in. So at the most recent training, we had information about how to most successfully navigate the CELI system, how to live stream actions that you're participating in so that more people can see what's going on and that we can share that message, how to approach a homeless camp and interact with this population that often doesn't have trust of people who are not also in their situation. And then we talked a lot about what it's like to be a community member who has that housing instability and how coming out for to support them is really important, and shared some things about what a community member's role could be in an eviction defense. And then there was concrete action training. So Rising Tide has organized a direct action portion of the training to give people tools in order to respond to these things and effectively support the defense of these people's homes.
And when we talk about defense, we are talking about a physical nonviolent intervention, right?
So there are many ways that people can participate in a defense through the Rapid Response Network. Part of it is documenting and live streaming, right, and sharing that video so that people see what is happening and see the way that these people are being treated by law enforcement officers and other state agencies that are supposedly there to support us. And then it's also a way for us to create an organized defense, like you were saying, of direct action to stop these governmental organizations from moving these people from a place that they have set up as their home to somewhere else.
So it's going to be at the SCIU building on 64th and Foster. Could you tell us the address for that?
So SCIU 503 Hall is at 6401 Foster Street. And we are having the training on March 9th, this upcoming Wednesday, 4:30 to 8:30. And there will be light snacks provided for people.
Before we wrap up our conversation about this direct action training, I just wanted to ask you why you think this will work. What experiences have you had that give you confidence in this kind of political tactic and strategy?
Well, first and foremost, Joe, I think that history shows us that people coming together to organize to meet their community's basic needs is the thing that does create change. And that's why I'm involved in this movement. But more than that, I think one of the things that really inspired me to participate in this project was an eviction defense that Portland Tenants United put on earlier this year, where a 73-year-old man was being evicted from his home for 33 years. And we didn't actually have to come to the stage of the direct action side of that demand in order to keep him in his apartment, because the threat of such action actually stopped the property management company from evicting him and vacated the eviction and kept this gentleman in his home. And so I've seen firsthand how people coming together to put pressure on people who think they have this type of power over us is a very successful tactic.
Well, that's all the time that we have. I'm Geo Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking with Austin Rose of Portland Tenants United about an upcoming direct action training this Wednesday the 9th, 4:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the SCIU 503 building at 6401 Southeast Foster, that's 64th and Foster. We will post links to information that we have mentioned. Thanks for coming on, Austin.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
And thank you, Joe and Austin. I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning. I'm here with Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, and they're going to take on the much-acclaimed Oscar-winning film Spotlight this morning. Jan and Mike?
Well, we'll be talking about Spotlight, the film that won Best Picture at the Oscars last month. Directed by Tom McCarthy, Spotlight is based on the true story of how an investigative team at the Boston Globe published a series of stories in 2002 on the sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church, exposing the collusion of the church hierarchy and covering up the scope of the problem. In accepting the award, producer Michael Sugar comments that, quote, "This film gave a voice to survivors, and this film amplifies that voice, which we hope will become a choir that will resonate all the way to the Vatican," unquote. Well, Mike, as laudable as this is, I'm struck by how big this choir is by this time, and it seems to be a same old song, and in many ways not at all informed by the thinking about the sexual abuse panic of the 90s that has unfolded since this investigative series of reports. Before talking about some of the problems with the film, what do you think the film accomplishes in its factual portrayal of the Boston Globe series and exposés on pre-sex abuse?
Well, on the one hand, it's a straightforward procedural movie, much like All the President's Men, where reporters are going around gathering facts and being stunned by what they've gathered and goaded on to gather more. And the movie did a good job, as did the Spotlight team, of bringing down the Catholic Church. Because before that, there had been isolated cases where priests had been caught and there had been settlements paid or even one or two criminal prosecutions in the 90s. But the practice by the church of moving priests from one parish to another and the systemic way in which the church was dealing with repeated examples of sex abuse had not been brought forth. And doing that was good work. But they kept on doing it, and as people do, they clung to what had got them fame, and they eventually published, as they said in the movie, more than 600 stories, and every single person who ever raised an accusation was given money by the church without question. In Father Shanley's trial, one of the people named in the movie, the victim was given $500,000 by the church before the trial began. He had been cut loose completely by the church, all this to great publicity in the Boston Globe. So he was standing there already having been convicted by his own church before the trial began.
And of course, very few people are sympathetic to accused priests, other than perhaps a church hierarchy, and that it has, these terms betrayal are used a lot. The sense of abuse by a priest. One young man said, "I always thought he was God," and I think this was itself revealing of the enormous authority priests have in their communities, the ways in which the priests are allowed to govern over people's lives, even though the suffering around issues women face and gays face, the tough and repressive policies and practices around sexuality, abortion, birth control, all of these issues make the church a kind of forbidding place, but it maintains its authority on the basis of this moral righteousness. So to expose this issue gathers up a lot of other grievances in the process, and perhaps that's part of the intensity, the momentum both of the cover-up, but also in the moral panic around the expose and the and all of the forces operating in an over-energetic expose.
What the movie left out is that the church is like a great beast, but it was brought to its knees and then killed dead.
Overstating it, but it was perhaps brought to its knees. But and there's a question of how much humility in this genuflecting before public opinion and the courts has really achieved.
Well, the authority of the church was replaced by the authority of the Spotlight team. The church stopped resisting in any way. Anyone who made any accusations was promptly given money. Tens of millions of dollars was given out to hundreds and hundreds of people. And the idea that nobody would be moved ever by the prospect of getting money in the United States of America, and that every single accusation was taken as a matter of faith.
No, there was this extreme state of innocence, the robes of innocence. In this sense, it was a very Catholic melodrama. You know, everybody's innocent and guilty at the same time. And the way this issue was raised around settlement seemed very problematic to me. The one lawyer who had been working around out-of-court settlements was taken up as a really smarmy guy because he had been settling cases out of court. But this is common practice, right? This is not...
Of course it is. That's what victims want. And the movie was one of its many distortions was that this guy was actually the chief source for both the Globe and for prosecutions in Boston, Eric McLeish. He was essential. It was his press conference that really got everything rolling and led to the Globe's first articles that they did in 2002. But they persisted. By 2005, when the Shanley trial took place, they had continued to publish a stream, an unending stream of articles on this subject. They had their secret tip hotline as if it were any danger at all in those days of being a victim. And the
But it adds to the drama.
Well, yeah, it does. And the prosecutions by then was an absolute classic moral panic. They relied on repressed memory therapists. Now, in order to explain why people who had never made any complaint at all are suddenly remembering 30 years later about a series of sexual abuse incidences while they were in catechism. Most people who had been advocating repressed memories had been disgraced. Millions of dollars of payments had been made by those therapists because it was clear they had induced memories that were verifiably false.
And there's no hint of that in this film. That's what makes it seem so frozen in time. There's nothing complicated about these accusations or other things that were driving this beyond just the righteous exposure of the guilty. All of the forces of virtue are on the side of those exposing. Even Richard Seip, author of Sex, Priests, and Power, was interviewed by phone in the film. He was a character by phone and claiming, based on his research, there are actually 6% of priests who are pedophiles, and this is accepted as a shocking fact. As though he has some way of systematically assessing this. These are numbers that are accepted on the basis of professional authority, on the basis of clinicians' own agendas around this particular issue, and accepted as fact.
Well, those numbers are interesting because when they first came up in the movie, they were stunning. They were at a time when they were thinking there could be as many as 13 priests, and this number, 6%, would have been 90. And they were all blown out. But as the movie tells us at the end, more than 250 priests by the end were defrocked. It's as if the swinging pendulums never stop in the middle. And once you see that this happens, every single priest was scrutinized and many were kicked out. Hundreds were kicked out for no discernibly good reasons. And it became impossible to make a wrong statement if you wore the jacket of a victim. No matter the Shanley's trial, there were inconsistencies and improbabilities. And they were...
Now, Shanley was one of the priests.
Yeah, he's the one named in the movie who was put on trial in
2000. Kind of a hippie left-wing gay priest.
Yes, yeah. they had very conservative right-wing priests, hippie, and certainly anybody who had surfaced at all was vulnerable, as was Shanley. But the prosecution explained that these inconsistencies had to be a result of having been traumatized. They said if he were a real liar, he would have made up a better lie. That's actually from the prosecutor's closing argument. The normal standards for assessing evidence and the truth were absolutely abandoned by 2004 and 2005 after several hundred of the Globe stories.
And this film is being held up as a model of investigative journalism that we are in a risk of losing in this country. And in my mind, it's an example of really bad journalism as it unfolded and as the stories told in this film.
It's an inability to be flexible and recognize the changes that happened. The church may have been omniscient in 2001, but by 2004 and 5, it was certainly on its knees. And we were met not with any skepticism, but with mindless faith. That's what the Globe is urging us to greet these accusations with. In criminal trials, every witness testifying for the prosecution is perfect, and every other witness is shamed by being associated with these pedophiliac priests.
So it's still a religious psychodrama in a way.
Yes.
The righteous and the evil clashing, no overlap. So this is Mike Snedeker and Jan Hocken talking today, putting the spotlight on Spotlight, the film that won the Academy Award last month.
I like that, the religious psychodrama. That seems like a good place to make some money, you know? Do you want to do a film, Jan? All right. Well, we've had a pretty full show this morning, folks, but there's lots more to come on KBOO. It's at 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia with Chris Andre, 10:15. Locus Focus is off today. Instead, we hear some public affairs programming with John Nichols and Robert McChesney. At 11, Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. Guest today is Diana Beresford Kroger. She's the author of the book, The Sweetness of a Simple Life. And at 11:30, we'll hear Madness Radio, a discussion about abolishing the term schizophrenia. Well, it is a collective labor that brings you the Old Mole every Monday morning at 9 a.m. And thanks to all of our Mole contributors and guests. We had Bill Resnick, John Foran, Jan Hocken, Kate Raphael, Jan Hocken again, and with Mike Snedeker talking about the film Spotlight, and Joe Clement and his guest Austin Rose, both of them from Portland Tenants United. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm your host, Denise Morris. Thanks to Joe Clement, our engineer. We'll see you next week.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month, on Thursday, March 10th at 7 p.m., KBOO at the Clinton will show Salt of the Earth. Based on actual events, this film depicts a strike by Mexican-American mine workers in New Mexico. Against a backdrop of social injustice, a family drama is played out by a miner and his wife. Again, that's Salt of the Earth, Thursday, March 10th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.